ShoeCast. Welcome one, welcome all to the final episode of the second season of the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things that we love about it. The man they know as Ticho Blanco is here for one last time before we agree to not speak to each other for a couple months. Gonna miss you, but what's up?
Ben, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. I'm really looking forward to not talking to you for a while and really just, you know, kind of decompressing and growing as an individual. And then we can, you know, hopefully come back together and be stronger than we are now.
We need some space.
Yeah. On my feet right now, I've got a pair of Viberg whole cut boots, waxed camel rough out. How about that?
The black ones?
Oh, yeah. These were like an MTO pair that I did up in Toronto. Do you remember when we used to be able to like travel to places?
Yes, vaguely.
Yeah, my wife and I like went to Toronto for like a long weekend, and I went to the Viberg MTO event at Lost and Found up there. Had a great time, ordered these boots, and they were running like a cool promotion where they were going to choose like one of the MTO makeups to do as like a full run. And then that person would get them for free. And I ended up winning. So I got these things for free. It's pretty dope.
Great work.
Thanks, man. But, you know, I figured I know we're talking Pacific Northwest. And we included Viberg in that. So I figured that would be my move today. What about you, sir? What do you got on your feet?
Well, I am once again wearing my Nix Robert boots in this just excellent Wicked and Craig harness leather. Every step that you take in these things just blesses them with more patina, and I cannot stop. So here they are. I'll talk about them more later in depth during the break, because this episode is once again sponsored by Nix Handmade Boots. Big thanks to Nix. Everyone give them a follow on the gram, sign up for their newsletter, all that good stuff. Pacific Northwest. Last season, we did an episode on the histories of hand-sewn makers in Maine and then also Russell in Wisconsin. And along with them, the Pacific Northwest, PNW, it's really many ways the last remaining epicenter of shoemaking in the U.S. So basically our goal here is to go way back and then through the years and tell the stories, often really very, very untold stories of some of our favorite brands from there. So we talked to the good people at White's, Wesco, Nix, and then also Viberg, even though they're Canadian and technically in the Pacific Southwest. You think we should allow them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's the same stretch of coast, right? What I like about that area is that a lot of it, former Russian territory from like way back in the day. Fun fact.
I'm glad it's not the case anymore. That would be weird. But yeah, we're just going to get into these long and honestly incredibly interesting histories. And man, did we come away with some gold here? Got a ton of facts and nuggets and insight that I think is really not out there. Like, I did not know most of the stuff that we learned talking to everybody at all these places, scouring old newspaper articles. So we're here to put it out there. You ready to do this?
Let's do it, man. I'm excited.
Me too. First up, White's Boots. Currently based in Spokane and have been for a while, but man, it took a while to get there. White's is really the oldest surviving bootmaker in America, especially if you trace it all the way back. It wasn't called White's Boots at that time. Edward White, he learned shoemaking in the Northeast. Nobody seems to have any idea what company it was for, but he started making boots. In 1880, Edward's son John White learned the trade from his pops, started making really this kind of bizarrely, given that it was 140 years ago, modern work boot in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. And it was just this pretty close approximation of what White's makes today, selling it to miners and loggers, which is two groups that come up a lot throughout these histories. So the land there in the Shenandoah had been totally overworked. There had been a lot of settlers. It was kind of one of the richest farmlands. There was a Civil War battleground there for this land, but it was overlogged, overmined. John saw the writing on the wall, packed up his family, moved to Wardner, Idaho with his son Otto to serve, once again, miners and loggers, 1900. Fun fact, in 1910, Wardner had a population of 1,400. Today, 176. Probably not the best place to start a boot company in 2021, but back then, 1,400 men, it's pretty much all you need. So they set up shop, logging camps, mining camps. They start making and repairing boots. Apparently, they repaired a lot more boots than they were actually making at this point. They were kind of cobblers first, which helped because they had to understand really shoes and boots of any kind. So John and Otto are there in Wardner for 10 years, and then they do this strategic split. Otto went to Kellogg, Idaho. John went to St. Mary's, Idaho, where I guess there's a big river. They're getting this lumber, moving it up and down the river, log drivers and cruisers, and this is like some real Wild West shit. And then in 1918, John goes to Spokane. Otto joins him in 1922 to grow the company, and this is around the time that the real business started. And instead of repairing boots and making some, Otto said, I'm going to make boots. This is really why White's is here today. So they bring in a bunch of new people. They knew how to make boots from somewhere. Otto taught them. Each bootmaker was making about 4 pairs a day, all completely handmade, almost no machines. Apparently the Rapid Stitcher, like the Rapid E-Machine, didn't come until sometime a little later in the 20s and took a little while to pervade. They were cutting uppers by hand with a knife. Apparently at White's, they still have a guy to this day who cuts them by hand when they're being developed or on like fully custom for that 5% that White's will make you a custom boot if you're, you know, if your foot and in a lot of cases legs just kind of don't match up with what you need from a stock boot. One thing I was told that if you have a bigger calf, this guy will draw it up and then cut it by hand, especially back then. So didn't matter who you were going to get a boot that fit you. And then White starts to take off here for two main factors. One is accessibility of Spokane to other areas via the rail line, which I haven't checked with Carl from last week, but it's possible that he did the electrical work on. Unsure. More roads are starting to be built, you know, more logging camps, mines. So accessibility to customers. And then two, Otto said, I've got a good enough product here and enough demand. Let's set up a dealership model. So there's dealers in Missoula and these other logging hubs. Otto is sending dealers catalogs. He's got wholesale pricing. Like until this point, you fit a boot to the guy. There was no stock boot. The real development here and the real innovation is that Otto says, everybody can get measured. You can have a boot in 4 to 6 days, but we're not going to make them fully custom. Let's concede a little bit and do standard sizing for like 80 to 90% of this market, which is pretty interesting. It's like just not how boots, especially these kind of boots, were made back then. So word starts to get around. Also at this time, 1926, Otto develops the Arch-Ease system, which is basically still like the that kind of major standing on the rung of a ladder arch that White's has to this day that would, in addition to providing support, would form to different foot types. So he worked with a podiatrist, combined what he knew about fitting with this medical outlook, and just developed this system that people really liked and created this custom feel even in stock boots. At this point, from about 1900, this is really cool. They're making basically today's 350 cruiser. That's the boot. The 350 was a 6-inch, the 375 was an 8-inch boot, and the 400 was a 10-inch boot. And then they kind of spread these out. The Packer boot, the Farmer Rancher, everything was pretty much the same pattern. Everything's on leather soles. It's one of the reasons they needed to be resold so many times, which was also kind of, you know, good for White's business. But yeah, man, like same boot. They didn't have a lace-to-toe boot until the 80s.
That's wild, man. But yeah, I guess, you know, when you're, you know, you're just making things that are really functional for people wearing these to work, you don't need all these like fancy, you know, different styles like we have today, I guess, right?
Didn't need them. One change there was the semi-dress. First showed up in 1932 in a catalog, is kind of how we have it dated. That was a huge deviation from the basic pattern. And that was made for like a guy who worked in a factory or a shopkeeper. It was lighter weight, you know, 5 inches. Apparently they were selling a ton of these in the Depression. So basically this White's name and reputation gets out there from the late 20s into the 30s. There's this guy, Francis Lufkin. You ever heard of this guy before?
No, man. Who's this guy?
I'd never heard of Francis Lufkin before either, but he was apparently one of the first smoke jumpers, like jumping out of like rickety airplanes in the 30s to put out forest fires. And eventually was like a trainer and foreman for this base in Winthrop, Washington. And in the early 30s, he's working for the Forest Service. His dad had been a logging driver in St. Mary's, so he knew about whites. Also, his grandfather was like, you got to get some of these whites. So he goes to Spokane, where they're at now, buys himself a pair of whites. So this was probably in 1933, bought a stock boot, started testing it for smoke jumping. Everybody's like, where'd you get these boots? And he told them, and they called him White Boot at that point. Became this cult classic. Francis Lufkin became like the original influencer. That's how the smoke jumper was born. I think it wasn't named that, or maybe even the guys weren't named that until the 60s or 50s or something like that. But word gets around and everybody starts buying these things. They were $12 at that point, which was like a week's pay at 25 cents an hour, which if that's what you're doing, might as well spend a week's pay on a pair of white boot.
That's wild, man. Yeah, I mean, first of all, this guy, 1930s, he's jumping out of planes to fight fires. Like,
insane. Even the parachutes must not have been that good back then.
I mean, I guess they were good enough, right? Like, he kept doing it. So that's wild, man. I don't know. I don't want to jump out of a plane like now. I'm imagining like one of those like biplane like kind of thing. He's like walking out on the wing and just kind of like jumping off and, you know, everything's on fire. Man.
I mean, it might not be far off. I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, Lufkin like really gets him going to kind of this national level of acclaim, especially because he's running this school and everybody starts plopping down $12 for white boots. Apparently they were using a lot of bullhide back then and elk hide. And apparently some of this bullhide on these boots was like 11 to 12 ounces, which is kind of double what even some of these PNW makers use these days. And apparently these guys were like slapping them on and just like going out on a jump the next day. I mean, these were like real ass people back then. God bless them.
That's wild, man. Yeah, I mean, 11 to 12 ounces, like, imagine the forearms on a guy who's lasting 11 to 12 ounce bullhide boots. That guy must have had some serious forearms.
With zero machinery whatsoever.
Right, right.
Man, there's got to be a pair of these out there somewhere. Got to get in touch with Lufkin.
I'd imagine they're all still around. They sound indestructible.
Yeah, somebody's like great-grandkid has these in a closet and doesn't even understand what's going on. Hopefully he's wearing them.
And jumping out of old-timey planes.
Yes, for sport. Otto just kept running the company, kept pushing it forward. He died in 76. This is probably the best fact that Whites gave us here. And shout out, by the way, to Jacob, who is doing this huge historical research project for Whites that, you know, we just kind of got to draft off of. So thank you, Jacob. You're doing absolutely the Lord's work. Otto kept telling bootmakers over the years, he'd say to these guys, some of the top guys, he'd be like, one day I want you to take over this company. They're like, okay, yeah, this is great. I got the nod from the big guy. And he never left. He was 93 when he died. Apparently he was still showing up in his 90s with his cane, watching guys to make sure that they were doing everything right and hitting them on the back of the leg if they like messed something up. Just walking around the factory. Like, he wouldn't let anybody get away with anything, and he led them all to believe that they were going to get to own the company, but he didn't leave and would hit them with canes instead. I love it.
I don't know why, but I'm picturing, like, old Biff from from Back to the Future.
Hello! Oh, man. Love Otto White. Love Otto White. I wish I was alive in 1975 and doing this. We would definitely have him on the podcast. He'd probably just yell at us. And so they kept going. Guys kept making four boots a day. That was just what you did at White's. And like, you know, making and the boot maker at White's is like, this is the guy that welts the boot. Obviously things are being cut and it's a slightly longer process than that, but that's especially how White's sees it. And it wasn't until the 70s when they said, I think we might be able to do more. In the 70s, a bootmaker was responsible for making seven boots a day. And then Eric Kinney, who made boots for whites for 26 years, runs the company now. He figured out how to get it to like 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and just build these efficiencies with his own knowledge for doing this for so long, filtering it down without cutting any corners. And of course, whites has kept that core smoke jumper and semi-dress lineup while adapting, really in many ways, those boots. Like my MTO 350 cruisers are, they're a smoke jumper pattern, this original whites pattern on a semi-dress last. And a lot of that stuff's been available, you know, especially for the last 10 to 15 years as this different customer base comes in. Got big in Japan in the early 2010s, started doing MTO for people there and here. You know, they have their Main Street Goodyear welted line now and Goodyear welt mock toes and the whole deal. There's been a couple changes in ownership post-auto, most recently selling to ABC Mart, the Japanese footwear retailer. They have a lot of stores in Japan, by the way. They're kind of everywhere. And I love this fact too, except for a few years here and there, a bootmaker has run the company for almost 170 years. And like I said, Eric did it for 26 years. He estimates hand sewing 50,000 pairs of boots over that time, which is just bonkers. The White's core customer is still there. Interesting thing that Eric told me a while back is that a lot of these smoke jumper guys, apparently they're wearing like really lightweight Italian boots that aren't NFPA certified because some of the like requirements for what you're supposed to wear have been lifted. They're not one of the only places that you can buy these boots from now, which is one of the reasons they expanded their kind of breadth of offerings to a larger customer base. And, you know, I'm happy about that because I have three pairs and I love them. That's whites. I mean, pretty fun stuff. Watch the backs of your leg, you know, if you ever happen to run into Otto somehow.
Yeah, if he's like haunting you or something.
I mean, what a way to haunt.
I mean, it sounds like he had an incredible influence over this company and they're still doing it to his specifications. So in a way, he is still alive and hitting people on the back of the legs with his cane, right?
Exactly. But yeah, it's like his dad and granddad, you know, they learned how to make boots. They passed that down. They basically built the same boot that they're making today. But Otto is like, we're going to do this Archie's thing and we're going to sell these boots everywhere. That's why we're talking about whites right now. So it's pretty cool. Pretty cool to think that you're making boots for 1,400 men in a logging camp and that's your whole business. And then say, I think we can sell these things everywhere. And this was slightly predating the internet. Not bad, Otto.
Well done, man. What a great history and a cool story. And it just kind of makes you appreciate what they're doing now even more. So thanks for sharing that with us, man.
Well, all thanks to Whites and especially Jacob. You're the man. All right, who's next?
So next up we have Wesco. The Wesco Shoe Company was started by a guy named John Henry Shoemaker.
No.
In 1918. Could you believe that? I have to imagine he just like woke up one day and was like, what am I going to do with my life? And just like looked at his driver's license or something and was like, there it is.
I mean, look, Ticho, I don't know if you know about this little thing called nominative determinism, but you may know of meteorologist Storm Field.
I do. Yeah.
Or perhaps world's fastest man, at least recently, Usain Bolt.
I sure do. Yeah.
But perhaps you don't know of water research scientist Andrew Drinkwater?
No, never heard of him. No.
You don't know about him? He's a real guy. Or rally race driver Scott Speed?
I have heard of Scott Speed. I'm a big rally racing fan.
Dude, I actually went to like rally driving school for 3 days in New Hampshire at one point where the pros train. It was fucking incredible. It was so fun.
That sounds super fun, man. That sounds awesome.
We should go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you probably don't know about random fireman Les McBurney.
Sounds like a guy who owns a few pairs of smoke jumpers, right?
Or perhaps most prominently, gastroenterologist Joshua Butt.
I love nominative determinism, and I feel like, you know, it really does affect the quality of services that you're getting. So I... a little bit about me, had a vasectomy.
Smart.
And I've specifically sought out a urologist whose last name was Wiener. He did a great job. I have had no children since that day. He uses like this great Chinese technique. It's awesome, man. Awesome. 15 minutes in and out.
I might need his number.
Thank you, Dr. Wiener. Thank you. You're the best.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously this whole idea is that you're named something and over time you're drawn to that field. All right. Well, what did our man Shoemaker do here? When did he make the shoes?
All right. So starting in the late 19th century, he starts working for a boot manufacturer in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Michigan, specifically like the Saginaw, Michigan area. I don't know how much you know Michigan. All I know, it looks like a mitten.
Mm-hmm.
They have really good square pizza, Detroit-style pizza. Have you ever had this?
I mean, Detroit pizza is phenomenal.
Amazing pizza. Well done, Michigan. Back in the day, that's where like all this, you know, logging is happening. They had, I guess, a lot of trees. Less so nowadays, I'm assuming. Eventually, he's like, all right, I'm done here in Michigan. Out west, that's where it's all happening, in the aforementioned PNW. He hops, I'm guessing, on a train or a horse or biplane, I don't know. And he's aiming to go to Seattle. But he runs out of money and ends up in Portland, Oregon. And there's a company called Bradley Shoe in Portland. And they're like, hey, we need people to like make boots and shoes and stuff. That's literally what we do. That's why we're called Bradley Shoe. And he's like, hey, man, like I just came from Michigan. I've been cranking these things out. It's awesome. So he works there for like 5 years. Goes over to the Goodyear Shoe Company. He's in the repair department. He's making shoes there. So he's got like 10-ish years of experience before he just decides, hey, I'm doing this on my own. I've got all the experience. I've got the knowledge. I know what I'm doing. Starts the West Coast Shoe Company, 1918, Portland, Oregon. Done. We're in the game. Initially, he's making these timber boots, which are, you know, like these spiked logging boots where they've got like hobnails, like stuck in the bottom. You know what I'm talking about? Like if you see a drawing of a lumberjack, he's probably wearing, you know, boots with like spikes on the bottom. That's what these are.
Quick aside here. I had this whole list of names for what to call Stitch Down before this thing started. There were various variations. I think I still own the URLs, or maybe they expired, for like the hobnail and also hobnailed. And I was running them past one of my buddies and he's like, dude, it sounds way too much like hobbit sex. Like, you can't do that. And I didn't. If anyone wants to buy the URL, let me know.
Anyone out there who is drawing a lot of Lord of the Rings fan fiction erotica, please contact Ben to purchase this URL.
It's a hot one.
It is available.
I should have gone with that. Yeah, I run this thing called Hobnailed. Would you like to advertise on our podcast?
Yeah, welcome to the Hobnail Nailcast.
The fuck was wrong with me?
So anyway, he's making these timber boots. It's like an 8-inch boot. Costs $18 at the time, which like, honestly, in the 1920s, it sounds like kind of a lot, as we kind of talked about the pricing back then.
Yeah, I mean, it's $6 more than a pair of whites. Jeez.
These are premium products, man. I mean, I'm assuming you have to do, you know, stick all those hobnails on by hand. That's probably pretty labor intensive. Like,
that's true.
I think it still was probably a good value back in the day. Yeah, so now you can, you know, have these like removable spikes, but back then they're like riveted. You can't take them off and it's like leather soled. So when you wear them down, you just got to rip the whole thing off. So yeah, in the process of doing some research here, Chris Warren from Wesco actually dug up a bunch of like old catalogs and order forms and a bunch of really cool stuff. And you've got that over there, right, Ben?
I'm not sure when this catalog is from. It's not dated, but it's old, believe me. So I'm going to read some choice bits from it. The kind of headline here is Logging with a Smile. They're starting off hot. The story of a shoe that will, quote, stand the gaff, G-A-F-F. That's kind of their slogan back then. It says West Coast Shoe Company, 6th and Burnside, Portland, Oregon. It says, attention, loaders who kick their tongs loose. Riggers who kick choker hooks and jaggers, also in quotes. Donkey punchers who burn their shoes up with engine oil, and fallers and buckers who come in contact with saw teeth and axes, can't expect their shoes to last as long as those of the man who, quote, watches his step and, quote, gives them a fair shake. Wesco's will stand the gaff if given half the chance. Ship them back if they don't.
It sounds like it was written by Rudyard Kipling.
Dude, this is world-class marketing material. I absolutely love it.
People need to bring that back in their, you know, like Instagram copy when they're like posting something. Like,
dude, totally.
Yeah, let's bring back that back. That sounded awesome.
I love Stan the Gaff.
What is the gaff? I don't know what a
Chris
gaff
didn't
is.
Seem to know what the gaff was either. It says, get this right. A shoe is no better than the leather it is made of. Still true. And all the leather on the market is not worth a whoop, in quotes, when there is no shoemaking skill. I mean, they were marketing these things just beautifully. Wesco logging shoes are pliable and give with your foot, which enables the logger to, quote, hit the ball and forget those italics bunkhouse foot aches. I love this part, too. Here's the dope. The soles are hand-sewed. There isn't a wooden peg in their makeup. The caulks are guaranteed to hold up and stay in. They're made of the best materials money can buy. They are made by the best workmen money can hire. There is no ridge inside to callus your feet. They fit around the leg, and they are made and sold only by us, factory to wearer. This is DTC at its advent. Of course, everything was kind of DTC at that point, but it's great. All right, I got to keep going here. Now there's this picture of John H. Shoemaker, proprietor, and it says, the big boss, the brains behind the Wesco logging shoes is a real, quote, shoemaker, both in name and performance. His actual experience covers a period of 33 years, and his operations cover a territory from the Maine forest out through the Michigan and Wisconsin jungles and on to the tall and uncut of the Pacific coast. He said he was too busy to have his picture taken, but we got the gang together and hogtied him and took him down. You loggers who don't recognize him can lay it to the fact that he's, quote, dolled up a trifle. This is the best shit I've ever read in my life. He isn't a, quote, highball shoemaker, but a great believer in thoroughness. So much, in fact, that he still insists on doing all his own cutting, which sometimes keeps him at his block into the night. He's forgotten more about making shoes than most shoemakers will ever know, but at that, he's raring to learn. Walk into the corner of 6th and Burnside and make us a call. Slam the door so we'll hear you enter. But if we don't hear you, then holler. Anyway, meet up with our push. Tell him what you want. Let him measure you up. And believe us, boy, you'll be surprised. I think this is like, I know we're all having a good laugh at this.
This is
incredible. I love this. The work that was put into this. They're sending these, it's kind of like a quadfold, you know, like tall pamphlet that they're sending out around the country to try and get these loggers to do this. They're sitting at the camps reading this, probably having a good laugh about it themselves. I think this is like an incredible piece of history that Chris found for us. Thank you, Chris.
That was amazing, man. I'm excited. I want to go slam the door and give him a holler, man. I'm jazzed up. It.
But again, you know, like this is how you make your mark. I don't think that, you know, we couldn't get our hands on old materials from Whites, but I have to imagine that they had like a similar brash panache. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, John Henry Shoemaker. I love that.
Thank you, 1930s copywriter.
That guy's the best.
That guy was the real hero. He crushed it. Speaking of being crushed, the Great Depression, not great for business. The Depression basically crushes Wesco's business in downtown Portland. He keeps all his like tools and stuff. I mean, as you heard, he's, you know, stays at his block till late in the night. He builds a house in Scappoose and basically just starts making boots in his basement, traveling out to these logging camps, fitting people, making custom boots, and then just like hand delivering them back after he gets back from his basement. Like all things, Depression kind of ends somehow. I'm not really sure what happened, but it ended. And so Wesco actually starts making boots in the same building that they're in like the mid 30s, which is like pretty cool. I love shoe factories. I love old buildings. And then just to know that there's all this history in this place where they've been doing the same thing continuously for going on 90, almost 100 years is just super cool to me. I'd love to get out there and visit it sometime. The late 30s got some big years introducing the Highliner, the Jobmaster, and the Boss Boot.
Heard of these boots.
Here's the story on the Highliner. Montgomery Ward, which is like an old department store, mail order brand, kind of like a Sears competitor, basically. They order thousands of pairs of these Highliner pole climber boots for like power linemen. Not like NFL linemen. I'm talking like guys who climb up poles and like deal with like electrical lines and stuff.
Right. Like Anthony Munoz. Right? Could be wrong.
I'm pretty sure Jonathan Ogden definitely owned a pair of these.
Kent Hull. Give me a little Kent Hull.
I'm a big DeBrickishaw Ferguson guy. So
DeBrick.
Anyway, they look like a normal work boot, and Montgomery Ward is like, hey, could you like improve this? Put like a side flap, do like a steel plate in the heel, build it up. So anybody who's like climbing anything is suddenly just clamoring for these things. So we got arborists. They're climbing trees all the time. I actually had some arborists working in my neighborhood, and they, for whatever reason, after they left, there were all these tiny empty bottles of Fireball whiskey scattered around our neighborhood. And like a bunch of my neighbors were like texting each other. We're like, hey, did those guys cutting those trees, were they like really hammered the whole time they were doing that? And the answer is almost certainly yes. So be safe. Wear in your highliners there, arborists. I'm worried about you. They did do a good job trimming the trees. So do your thing, guys. So anybody, like nobody was really making a boot specifically for linemen to be climbing stuff, you know? And so this highliner kind of takes off. It's like really popular amongst, you know, anybody who is doing a similar type of activity, which is pretty cool. It's kind of the probably where it originated. Seems like that's maybe not certain, but sure seems likely. So then you got the Jobmaster, which I kind of hadn't really put together why it was called the Jobmaster, but it was just that you could use it for a bunch of different jobs. Stuff. But you could just do this for any job.
Master them all.
These are your boots. Even like a urologist could probably wear these. So
the denim urologist. I love that guy.
I know like a denim veterinarian. I know a denim dentist. I want the denim version of every medical specialty. Hit me up if you're a denim urologist. I want to hear about what that's like. So anyway, but the main jobs they're actually talking about, construction, firefighting, being a miner. Actual jobs where you need, you know, really good boots. So the soles on these, a little less aggressive, a little more, you know, for day-to-day. Even for, like, farming, they could wear, you know, people would wear them for farming. It pretty much just could do anything, which is the reason it's called the Job Master. Pretty cool.
One of the tightest names in the game, I gotta say. Job Master. I love it.
Yeah, I hadn't put it together, and now I'm it. So next you got the Boss Engineer, which I had assumed was named after Bruce Springsteen. I live in New Jersey, so I'm like really, you know, a little bit more Springsteen-centric than most people. It sounds like they named it after the big boss himself, John Henry Shoemaker. Seems more likely than what I had thought. So anyway, these were commissioned by guys who worked at the port, who were like welders on ships. They're dealing with all this like hot slag. I feel like we had like a gen fact about this.
I think hot slag is in 1/3 of all gen facts.
Yeah, I think Jen has a real affinity for hot slag.
And I think like their laces kept getting burned too, Chris told me.
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, like
they're just igniting. Like, shit. I just got to wait for these laces to burn off before I could kick off my burning boots. So yeah, engineers kind of work.
Engineers, great solution for that. That's like kind of where those came from. It's cool to look back at why something looks the way it does now, where it's, you know, been a little bit pulled away from that original use, right? Like guys who are welding on ships today, I doubt are wearing engineer boots. Maybe they are, but I kind of doubt it. And it just kind of moves into this like more fashionable space, and you kind of like lose like, hey, why does this look like this? I love stories like that. I think that's really cool. Moving on to like the 1950s and 60s, the motorcycle guys get really into the Boss boots and they become like huge in the motorcycle world. I get it. Seems like that style is going to be really comfortable and nice for riding a motorcycle. I don't ride a motorcycle, although I'm like kind of thinking about learning, which is another story.
No Fireball before the motorcycle, okay? One mini bottle max.
It's cinnamon, right? It's like a cinnamon something. I don't want to drink that. That sounds disgusting.
Yeah. Drink a much better, more delicious liquor before riding your motorcycle for the first time ever.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good tip. I feel like I'm going to want to wear engineer boots when I ride it because I think that'll just be cool, right?
Correct.
It just feels like that's cool.
But people didn't for a while. Like they fell out of favor. And I think in the 90s until now, they came back, which is like kind of weird. I don't know why they gave them up. Just like those things are hot, you know, your legs are against the engine almost.
Dude, I feel like the 90s were a very weird time for shoes in general. Like they probably switched over to wearing like Keds or something. Like,
yep, we're all familiar with those images.
The motorcycle guys they've bounced back from the 90s. They're back on track. They're back doing the engineer boots, which are cool. I actually have a pair of Wesco engineer boots sitting right here. They're like black wax flesh. I look at them and I'm like, I want to wear these to ride a motorcycle. So I get it. Another cool aspect of the Wesco story is that they have been featured in a number of feature films. Did you know this?
No. Tell me more.
The Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio, who
pissed in a lot of bottles.
What?
I've never seen that movie, but that's what I've been told by everybody who's seen it, is that he just pees in bottles for some reason. And also wears cool boots.
Wait a minute, that's in the movie? Is you just see him peeing in a bottle in the movie?
I mean, I don't think it's like full frontal, but
I've never seen this movie either, but that seems like a strange thing to feature in a
Anybody
movie.
Who knows anything knows that the best rendition of Howard Hughes is in The Rocketeer.
Love The Rocketeer, man.
I designed the Cirrus X5, X9, whatever the fuck.
Well, anyway, so he, in this movie where he's playing Howard Hughes, he's wearing these like really high lace-up boots. They're like 10 eyelets and like 12 hooks or, you know, something crazy. So it's like a Martin Scorsese movie. I don't know how you feel about Martin Scorsese. I find him a little hit or miss.
I mean, he's got some hits. Come on.
Some big hits and some other ones that are, to me, just like way too long and really boring. But he's pretty obsessive about like getting it right, like getting period stuff to look really good. So these boots, they had to have like a double row stitched leather aged midsole and just like look, you know, old timey and like beat up and stuff. So the guys at Wesco apparently took the hides into the parking lot and they started like scraping them with rocks and bricks to like soften them up and like put a lot of pressure on the leather and get it all like marked up and like aged and old looking. The plant manager apparently drove over the hides with his truck.
That's great. Anything for Martin.
I want to know, like, how much of an upcharge is there for, like, a regular customer to call and be like, I want the Scorsese special. Go drive over the hide with your truck a few times and hit it with rocks and bricks and stuff. You know, Weiberg had done those, like, aged kind of things where, you know, he poured acid on the eyelets and, you know, oil on it and stuff like that. There should be somebody who just does that. That should be somebody's job. Actually, our buddy Frank, who used to work at Weiberg, he does that for people sometimes. So if you want somebody to pour acid on your boots, hit up Frank. Or call Wesco and see if they'll drive over your boots with a truck. All right, here's some other ones. Terminator, Arnold, wearing Wesco engineers.
Love it.
I've never seen the original Terminator, but I have seen Terminator 2 like 14 times. It's a fantastic movie. I love it. I've never noticed Arnold's boots in it, so I'm going to have to like give it a rewatch. All right, Ghost Rider, Nick Cage.
The greatest of all time.
Also wearing Wesco engineers. I have seen Ghost Rider. Underrated film. Underrated. Now, Jason Momoa, who people might know as like Khal Drogo and like Aquaman and just generally an incredibly handsome man. I mean, just beyond good looking. He also loves his Wescos, man. And he wore them in Aquaman. Now, this is my question. He wore them in Aquaman. Did they have to do anything special to, like, because he, I assume, was underwater.
I think he's like a fish, right? Or something?
It was Aquaman.
I haven't seen that one. There's probably some land scenes. At some point, he's not Aquaman, right? And he becomes Aquaman. I don't know. I might have to watch that one. People say it's good.
I actually have heard it's good, but it sounds like, oh, he's a superhero, and it's like, oh no, what am I going to do? Maybe I'll just do my scheme on land where I'm not going to encounter this guy. Just a thought.
Just so he can wear the boots.
I guess if he's going to pop out and wear cool Wescos, maybe I'm in on it.
And Momoa's like just a big Wesco guy in general, too. He personally loves them. I think this is kind of a Harrison Ford situation, I think, where it wasn't Scorsese saying, all right, I know the guys with the trucks in a parking lot. It was him being like, yeah, look, I'd love to do this movie, but you have to figure out a way for me, a man who is also Aqua, to be able to wear Wesco boots in it.
That is pretty cool. I didn't realize that Scorsese also directed Aquaman.
That was one of the hits. So Wesco is really interesting. They've been parts of popular culture and, you know, kind of very specific subcultures. And they've been doing this for, I think, last year or 2 years ago was their 100th anniversary. For that, they kind of brought back a lot of nail down construction and like O'Sullivan soles and, you know, kind of harken back to this old past of theirs. And I know Chris wants to do more of that stuff too. Wesco, kind of more than anybody in this whole grouping, is just doing what they do, adapting it for different customer bases and doing MTOs for anybody who wants them. And shout out to Wesco. Shout out to John H. Shoemaker. Shout out to that marketing copywriter. Another fascinating tale, and I love how these are all like, there's similarities, but they're all different. Great work again to Chris for digging all this stuff up. But look, we need a break. We'll be right back with more PNW Cast. Ticho, we are back once more to talk about our Knicks boots, how we're feeling about them, the lives that they've been living. Last week, you had a great update on your Comstock derbies, but this week it's my turn. to talk about my Robert boots, which you saw in person when we had a lovely socially distanced hike and photo shoot.
That was a lot of fun, man. And I appreciate you, you know, going out and getting me a really nice falafel. Is it gyro or hero? How do you pronounce that word?
Where I come from, it's gyro. End of discussion.
I also say gyro.
I am sorry about the tomatoes.
Yeah, I did order it without tomatoes, which you didn't attend to, but that's fine. I picked them off.
Shout out Left Terrace Gyro, Tarrytown, New York. I have a confession to make. Because these Robert boots of mine are in the leather that Nyx is just experimenting with at this point, on me, apparently, and bless you guys for that, I named the leather wrong. The first time we did this, I said it was Wicket and Craig English Bridal, but in fact, it's Wicket and Craig Mill Buck Brown Harness. Accuracy is very important on this show, even if we have to admit our follies. Look, I've been doing a lot of what you've been doing, minus the streams. I don't have a lot of stream access over here. Tons of hikes. Are these things, or either of these pairs, purpose-built hiking boots or shoes? No, but they function really pretty darn well for a couple miles, even on rocks. But yeah, the Vibram 700, which I also have on mine, the V-Tread or Chevron, really loving it. The leather is just eating patina, getting darker. One of the leatherwork guys in the Stitchdown Premium Discord told me he has a suspicion that milled leather patinas faster. I'm not about to dispute that after my experience with these. I'll definitely post some pictures soon so everyone can get a look. Oh, this is good. When I walked out my door the other day to go on a hike, there was a deer maybe 3 feet away from me, like a 10-point buck. And he certainly spooked me, but I spooked him more. He just ran right away, tore off, and I think it was because he was so blown away by the beauty of these boots. And he was a truly beautiful animal, Ticho, but I think he knew he was beat.
Yeah, wild animals have like a real sense for, you know, game recognizes game, I think.
Wow, that was actually a pun and quite a good one. I don't know if you intended to do that.
Thank you. I was pretty happy with that one.
Anyway, I've been really, really happy with these. It is great with Nyx to have this boot that, like, they look good. And you know that you can't do anything to harm these boots. And it feels like that too when you're wearing it in a comforting manner. I love it. One of my favorite feels. Look, that's the Nyx boot update. I think you did a great job of wearing boots and then talking about them, which I know is a tough task to put you to. We're going to keep wearing them hard deep into the future. Yeah, thanks for everybody for coming along on this little update ride the last three episodes. Big thanks again to Nyx. Back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back. So, Ticho, time to talk about that anomaly from the Pacific Southwest of Canada, but we're definitely going to count them, Viberg. 1931, Edwin Viberi, according to Lars from Osmu, started himself a boot company in Saskatchewan, Canada. So, Ed, kind of unlike the first two brands and Nyx, was really making boots specifically for farmers. So, it wasn't necessarily logging at this point. And mining, although they got into it, and just kind of anybody looking for this hardy, long-lasting, all-around work boot. A lot of this research, too, is based on a story on the Viberg service boot, which you can check out on stitchdown.com, that I worked on for months and months and talked to everybody over there and just dug around the internet. There's this picture of the first boot that they made, which is incredible. And it looks just like today's service boot in terms of the pattern. Like the last is very, very different, but it's like a really handsome boot and it's kind of the same boot, which is just incredible, really. Like how much these things persist. Same with whites.
Yeah, see, I think that is so cool, man. I think it's great when you can like look historically and say like they've been making the same pattern boots for 75, 80 years, whatever. I'm not good at math. I think that just adds to my enjoyment of the boots to just know that they're like pretty historically accurate, right?
90 years this year. I did that in my head.
Hey, good for you.
So at the end of the 40s, Ed moves his operations to Prince George, British Columbia, where there is tons of logging. All these boot companies at some point realize like this is where it's at. These guys need boots. They're tearing them apart. If they're no good, let's make them something that lasts for a long time. So he's making boots for loggers. They actually developed, apparently, replaceable spikes for logging boots. So we mentioned all those hobnails and, you know, just these kind of crazy constructions that you need to tear the whole thing off and put it back on. Viberg says, we're going to make these things even more rebuildable. we're going to let you replace these spikes on the go, which is a pretty cool development. And then they're just kind of doing this for a while and persisting and, you know, making these innovations. In 1970, Glenn Viberg takes over, still in the factory to this day. From that point, things still kind of remain the same. And, you know, they're making these work boots, making logging boots. Around 2007, 2010, Japan figures it out. Apparently, Ed was over there and starting to push things. Brett Viberg starts to get involved at this point. It's not that product. They're not logging. They get all into, you know, our beloved 145, 245s, Bobcats. Check out that the service boot story because there's a couple pictures of those. But, I mean, DM me and I'll send you some more. Just these amazing, like, chonky double midsole, like 110 and work boot last, you know, on these huge wedges. Some of my personal favorite nostalgic Vibergs of all time are being made in the Pacific Southwest and then making their way over, especially to Japan at this point. And they still have this service boot. It's like a standard product. It's an 8-inch work boot with a packer toe, usually a higher heel. According to Brett, quote, just a typical Western industrial. He finds a picture of this original Viberg boot in the factory and starts to develop this modern service boot. He takes the old pattern, starts messing around with work boot last. There's some pictures of those in the story too. You know, they're 8 inches tall. They're kind of like very blobby compared to the service boot that Viberg makes today. Brings them to like this big trade show, Bread and Butter in Berlin, sells exactly zero of them. He's like, I got to figure it out. And nobody cares because they're just not there. And so, of course, he goes to the 310 service boot, which is this incredibly funky last that he built, combining the spring line last that he had made with a Dayton Tuffy, Dayton, another Canadian bootmaker, the box toe from that, and puts this thing together and, you know, kind of sands it down a little bit. And these things start selling. Japan, Hong Kong, in Taiwan, like these proto workwear guys in Germany. This is another quote from Brett that I love. Maybe some random Scandinavian stores and a few workwear guys in England. Everything at this point is nailed down construction, which is just very, very simple to make. And according to Brett, he says, all you need is hammer and nails aside from the last and the upper. That allows it to be repaired on site, at a work site, or during a battle. So you can literally just nail on the sole when it's worn out and keep going. That would be bad if it fell apart in the middle of a battle.
I feel like I might sort that out. Like if I see a battle brewing, I might take a look down at my soles and be like, you know what? Let me sneak a resole in before this battle starts. Yeah, I don't want to deal with that mid-battle.
No, you don't. But then stitch down construction happened. So they've been using it on a lot of these Japanese products, but it hadn't been used on the service boot until Brett develops the 2030 last, which was based on this Canadian military last. One of the really interesting things about stitch down, especially for that point at Viberg, you could create a boot with an unstructured toe because of the way that the construction kind of holds it up a little bit, like at least for a while. But if you did that on a Goodyear welt boot, especially with that kind of overall profile, it kind of wouldn't really work. They start using stitch down on all this stuff. There are a couple pictures on this old like blogger site that they had, but nobody's really buying these things. And so then Guy Ferguson, who is running the shop Four Horsemen, which is like right down the street from Viberg, but he's never heard about Viberg because they're just making these work boots, finds out from one of the other guys who works there, walks in, asks for Brett. Brett's not there. Eventually, he just walks into the Four Horsemen shop one day. He's like, hey, I heard you were looking for me. And they develop really the first meaningful service boot, this black on black with grain against rough out service boot, which was on a 2030 last, which was completely not what anybody was buying or had ever seen before. Guy gave me this quote for that story. He's like, man, we just bought like $15,000 worth of boots and nobody's going to buy them. And they sell out in a week, you know, without the internet helping them really. That was kind of the start of the Viberg that we know today.
That's super cool, man. I've actually seen a pair of those OG Four Horsemen boots pop up on Grailed in my size. And I was really tempted to get them just for like the historical value of them. And somebody was quicker and snagged them out from under me.
They're pretty cool to this day.
Really cool, man.
This is a nice looking boot. And then, you know, they're making these things. They're doing some MTOs. I think that blogger site is shut down, but I managed to kind of weasel my way into the internet archives. you know, if you left a comment, Brett would write back and like make you a boot kind of through that process. But it's still like small scale, selling to some shops. You know, they're selling these 310s in Germany. It hasn't completely caught on yet. And it's an expensive boot at this point. The price isn't really all that different 10 years ago. And then the Barney's boot happened. So Nigel Caburn, British guy, big in Japanese fashion, teams up with Brett and Barney's, and they make this rough out service boot that went through that process that you were alluding to earlier, where Brett's like dumping oil on them and pouring acid on eyelets and just doing all this insane stuff to make these things individually disturbingly patinaed. It went well, you know, they started to sell dozens and dozens of these things at Barney's, start to get some, you know, visibility for just a completely different audience. And around this time, you know, this community is forming around people who are just really, really, really into boots and footwear in general. People start hearing about Viberg and talking about Viberg. Andrew Chen from 316, kind of one of the early proponents, met Brett, I think, at Bread and Butter. I was like, hey, I want to get a pair of these things. He got a pair in this harness leather that Brett just had sitting around, unstructured toe, 2030 service boot, wore them to hell, and then posted some pictures of them on the internet, I think on Shoes That Look Better With Age on the Super Future forum. And everybody's like, oh my God, look at these things. The perfect beaten boot has arrived. And things just kind of really started to take off from there.
Yeah, man. I remember first hearing about these things on, might have been on Style Forum or Reddit, but like way back in like, you know, 2014, 2015, and people are just going crazy for them. And at the time, I wasn't like a real big, you know, like work booty kind of guy. I was like, you know, big dress shoe guy. And I was like, wow, these look really cool though. It's not this big chunky kind of thing. It's sleeker. It's, you know, more stylish. And you know, then they started doing like the sample sales and stuff like that. So I went to one in New York, and I actually lived in DC at the time, and I was like taking the train up there. My wife was like really pregnant. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to go and check it out and like meet up with some like, you know, people off of like the internet, like internet shoe friends. And she was like, yeah, that's super weird, but like, you know, do your thing. And she's like, but you're not going to buy anything for yourself? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Like, it's not super my style, I guess. She's like, that's really stupid. Like, you should just buy a pair. So shout out to my wife for supporting my love of Viberg's that has now blossomed. I think I've got like, I don't know, 5 or 6 pairs. That's probably undercounting.
What'd you get?
So at the first one, I got the Viberg by 316 stealth boot. So like 2030 stitch down service boot, black chrome XL, pretty straightforward boot, but like really nailing that design. I mean, just a great, great looking boot. I love those boots, man. I took the bar exam in those boots. Like, those will always have a special place in my heart. I was like, oh, I've got to take this bar exam. My son had been born like the night before. And so I was like, yeah, I need to like put on these boots that are going to fill me with like, you know, a little bit of magic, a little bit of power, and I can go and crank this thing out because I've barely slept and it's kind of nuts. They carried me through. So that to me is Viberg.
I think to most people, the bar exam, the day they pass the bar exam is what defines Viberg for them. For most lawyers, I would say.
Yeah, I feel like if you wear Vibergs to take the bar exam, you'll probably, within a few years, stop being a lawyer and start working in the footwear industry.
And then it's like makeup after makeup, pushing boundaries, bringing in leather that nobody else is using.
I actually just bought another pair of Vibergs yesterday.
Oh, did you?
I don't have even told you this, I think. I kept seeing everybody post pictures of their Color 4 Shinky horsehide boots. And I was like, oh my God, these are...
The ones that just came out.
They just came out. They look absolutely incredible, like over the top good. I couldn't resist. So those are on their way.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
But yeah, I think it's really interesting how, again, all these stories are similar, industrial product and... You know, developments are made and a lot of that soul and sometimes the exact pattern is still here today, but they're all different. And I think that the most interesting part about Viberg is just how they really pushed a lot of this kind of rugged but refined boot revolution into the forefront and kind of how it happened in all these random ways and fits and starts. And then you have this today, you know, this incredibly influential bootmaker. It's pretty neat and still, you know, still got the guts of the old stuff. That's Viberg. Who's next?
All right, well, next, we get to talk about sponsor of this episode, Nick's Handmade Boots. Nick's Handmade Boots starts as Nick's Shoe Shop by Nikolai Balushin, 1962. Now, this guy seems like an absolute legend. The good folks at Nick were able to get you some pretty awesome articles about Nick, right?
Just buckle up, because this stuff is bonkers. We've got this from the Spokane Spokesman Review, 19th of August, 1962. The long, long walk to liberty. Freedom is an old fight for Nikolai Balushin. A native of Chernigov, he was forced into the Russian army. While he was serving 300 miles from his home village, the Germans overran the Russians. Somehow, Nikolai escaped. And then he began his long flight home. For 7 straight months, he walked by night. Russian farmers sneaked him food, hid him from the Germans by day. The long, valiant walk went for nothing. At home, the Germans recaptured him, sent him into Germany as forced labor. American liberation rescued him. Why America for Nikolai? In stumbling English, Nikolai puts it very bravely. Here is freedom. So that's nuts.
What an absolutely crazy story. You spend 7 months walking like on this incredible journey, and then you get home, and it's like, oh, we gotcha. That must have really felt like shit.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have really felt bad.
That was a bad day. That was a bad day. All right, we got another one from the Spokane Chronicle. No date on this one, but we're pretty sure we know when it is. This is in the People and Business section. Former Russian opens shoe shop. This one's a little longer, so I'll just give you some highlights. But born in the Ukraine, okay, he's from Ukraine, of Russian descent, Nikolai Balushin learned how to make shoes from his parents, both shoemakers. It says he opened up his business. At this point, he's kind of glossing over some of that backstory, interestingly. I would tell it to everybody. But he began making shoes at home in the Ukraine at the age of 12. At the age of 14, he went to work for a shoe shop where he remained for 4 years. Then he went back to work side by side with his mother and father, making and repairing shoes and helping maintain a small farm where the family resided. Then it gets into the light version of that whole crazy story. Basically, he gets to New York in 52. The World Council of Churches Refugee Division found a job for him on a farm near Deer Park, Washington, where he worked for a while, and then he gets a job at White's. So he's applying these skills, works there for 15 years, and has just opened Nick's Shoe Shop at this point. Love this part. He enjoys hunting, fishing, boating, camping, swimming, and skiing. His wife joins him in some of these interests, as well as the more feminine pastimes of gardening, knitting, and sewing. Oh, it was a different time.
Well, I do like the title that they're like, yeah, he's a former Russian. Like now,
Former Russian.
You know what he is now? He's American. Chose to come here because here is freedom. We're welcoming him. Shout out to you, old-timey newspaper, for being accepting.
Let's just recap that. Lifetime cobbler, second generation, although apparently, according to the guys at Nick's, cobbler may have been misused. It sounds like his dad and his mother and he were all like actually making boots. Evades the Germans in the war. Walked at night for 7 months, possibly wearing boots that he made. He was definitely repairing these things as he kept walking. Recaptured, liberated by Americans. Comes to New York, works for White's for 15 years, starts making his own boots in 64, and opens his own shop in 67. Man, Nick Balushin, absolute legend. I didn't know this stuff.
Yeah, like I had heard like, oh yeah, Nick's, it was opened by some guy who used to work at White's, but I didn't realize that he had this incredible story to even get to that point.
Unbelievable. I love it. So yeah, so like what was he making?
So he's essentially, when he's starting out, he's making, you know, basically what they now have as the Builder Pros. In like 1977, they get certified by the NFPA, which is like the National kind of like Firefighter Association or whatever. So they start making these boots with Kevlar thread, which leads to the Hot Shot Fire Boot, which is a great name for a boot. I feel like Nick's has really good names for their models. Hot Shot. I love that. They're also doing stuff for farmers, for ranchers. They've got a Ranger boot, a Packer, you know, pretty good range of stuff. Our guy Nick, he owns and operates Nick's for like 25 years. He retires in like the mid-80s, and he lived all the way up until the year 2000. What a life. What a guy.
Seriously.
I'm so glad to have heard his story. In like the early 80s, which I also like that he sold this company and kept working at it for like five years.
Unbelievable, right?
Nowadays, it's like, oh yeah, I sold my company. I'm, you know, going to go head off to the islands or something and go hang out. But no, he kept working there for 5 years. It's great. In 1981, he sells the company to this guy, Gary Myers, who had also been a bootmaker at White's. And so it might have just been like the two of them working there at the time. That's kind of unclear. But anyway, this guy Gary, way more of like a Western kind of guy. I'm picturing him as like a Sam Elliott type of guy, right?
I have to send you this photo. Wouldn't let me share the folder. But yeah, he has this massive mustache. There's this one picture where he's holding a beer in the shop and it shows the back of his belt and it just says Gary in these huge letters. And like, he looks cool as all hell. Like, I want to hang with Gary.
Yeah, he also sounds super cool. Because of him, they get more into like the Western scene, you know, exotic cowboy boots, the ostrich vamp kind of stuff. I mean, Western boots are pretty intricate, pretty, you know, I would say works of art in a lot of cases. It's not really like my style or what I'm into, but I really like, you look at the stuff and you're like, man, these are really well made. They're also kind of in alignment with that. They started sponsoring some horse races. I know you sent me this photo of the Nick's Custom Boots purse.
It's like a local horse race. And they're like standing there with horses and the signs there. Like, that's just what he was into.
Yeah, I feel like if you own a company and you're, like, into stuff, you should sponsor the stuff you're into. That makes sense. So, you know, the, like, blue-collar kind of people in the West, they get more into wearing cowboy boots, like, casually. And up until the 90s, like, everybody's just doing the cowboy boots. They're doing Packers. And Knicks is just crushing it with them right now. But doing handmade toe bugs and, you know, all these intricate designs, it's like a pretty low margin business because it's so labor intensive to make them all. Our guy Gary, he owns the place up until 1991. And then he also worked there after he sold it.
They can't get away.
These people just love working there. He works there for a while. And then this was in 1991, then drove a truck for the next like 25 years before he retired.
Yep.
For a produce company.
So Gary passed in 2019, and there were a number of obituaries about him that I read. One of the things that I loved about it is that it said that he made so many friends through driving this truck, and he just like, he loved it, and he did it until, you know, he was pretty darn old and, you know, had left behind this boot world long ago. It's pretty cool. There's some cool people who've been running Knicks over the years, no question.
Yeah, this guy sounds really cool. And I wish I had half the mustache that he does. This thing is great. So then Knicks gets bought by this guy, Steve Mao, who had done like logging, you know, when he was younger. He wore Knicks. So he still owns it. Got his son, Shiler. They run the company. And so they took Knicks, you know, more into like the lifestyle heritage market in 2010. You've got a good story about the origin of your own robber boot. Is that right?
Okay, yeah, so I love this one. Talking to Nathan at Knicks about all this history stuff. The Robert boot, which I'm wearing right now, he says, a logger walked in one day, asked for a pair of boots that his wife would let him go to dinner in with her, took a 6-inch Ranger boot, put on a slimmer sole, and bam, like all of a sudden, Knicks has got a lifestyle product. The future just kind of unfolded from there. And for the last 10 years, they've been pushing deeper and deeper into that crossover market, still making a ton of work boots, ton of fire boots, you know, the hardcore stuff that Carl Murawski from last episode wears. Yeah, lifestyle stuff that's built no less, and, you know, using this Wicked and Craig veg tan, which is a completely different kind of leather than they've ever used, and have a great range. But there's amazing stories here, fantastic characters, Otto and all the Vibergs and a man named Shoemaker. This duo at Knicks, I think, gives everybody a run for their money. It's such interesting people who have made these companies, and I don't think that's an accident.
Look, we're talking about these companies because they still exist and are still relevant to us as enthusiasts who are into this stuff. You probably think like, yeah, there's a bunch of guys who are out in mining camps in Idaho back in the 20s who didn't have a company that ended up lasting for 170 years. I think it does take something special to take a business from, you know, that kind of humble beginning and turn it into the really cool, interesting companies that we see today. And it takes a lot of really hard work by some really visionary people. And I'm really glad that we got to hear some of their stories today. This is really cool, really interesting for me.
I love this episode. Look, big thanks to Knicks for sending over all these incredible newspaper articles on Nick and photos of Gary, and of course, for sponsoring this episode. Look, Ticho, it's time to say goodbye to each other, as this is it for this season of the ShoeCast. What are you going to do with your time off?
Well, I'm probably going to go out in the woods and take pictures of moss and think about my place in the universe and just generally reflect on things, general like self-reflection. And, you know, hopefully we can come back and make more of these podcasts and hear some more cool stories and talk to some more cool people. And you know what, man, I've had a lot of fun doing this, and really appreciate the work that you put into this. And I'm really glad that we are able to do this. So thanks to you, and thanks for everybody who listens to this. Didn't expect anybody to care. So
not for a moment.
It's pretty cool.
You're all crazy. You didn't ask, but I'm gonna basically be spending the coming month and a half to 2 months before we return just working on how well I can stand the gaff, my gaff standing exercises. I'm looking forward to that. I'm hoping for positive results.
Send me some send me some videos of you practicing, and I'll give you some feedback. I'm really advanced at standing on the gaff.
I don't know if you stand on the gaff. I think you stand it. I think.
I've been standing on it, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
I might look elsewhere for feedback. But look, it's been great. I have similar heartfelt feelings. But never fear, we shall return. We just need some sleep. Look, everybody, take care of your shoes. We'll see you in a few months.